Well, hello and welcome to Star Cells and God. This is the show where we look at new discoveries taking place at the frontiers of science, the ones that have theological and philosophical implications, as well as new discoveries that point to the reality of God's existence. My name is Jeff Zwerink, and I'll be your guide as we go through our show today. But before we get into our discussion, I want to encourage you to subscribe to our channel, Reasons to Believe. Click on the bell icon so you can be informed of new videos. And you can learn more at reasons.org or by following us on social media. At RTB underscore official. Well, Steve, I'm really glad to have you here today. I've just enjoyed getting to know you over the past months. Why don't you, if you could, just give us a little bit of introduction of who you are, what's your background, kind of a little bit of how you came to know Christ, some of your scientific interests, those sorts of things.
Sure. My name is Steve Berchi. I'm trained as a chemist and a pharmaceutical scientist. I've been in the pharmaceutical and chemistry field for about 40 years. Pharmaceutical about 35 years. I was raised in a Christian family, and I cannot actually remember a time when I didn't believe in God or know God. It's so early that I can't really remember not having that awareness and feeling. And so I don't have a great conversion story. I just have one that says and not that I've lived that out perfectly for sure all the time. But I've never had a period where I really doubted God's existence or didn't believe in Jesus as my Savior.
You know, it's interesting because your testimony is kind of similar to mine in a lot of ways. I mean, I do remember the night where I was at Awana and prayed to receive Christ, but there's never been this, does God exist or whatever. It's just kind of been the environment, it's the world I lived in. And so it was the natural extension of what I did rather than this 90-degree change from where I was going, or I guess 180-degree change. Making a right angle is not that big a deal. So
yeah, and I consider it a real blessing. I've been spared some grief. I've had my share of grief in life, but I've always had that confidence that somehow God was watching over.
Right. Well, what got you interested in the pharmaceutical industry? Why that direction?
Well, it's interesting because I was a baseball player in college, and that's all I wanted to do. My talent in that area is attested to by my current occupation, which is chemistry. So when I didn't make it, I had to figure out what to do, and I got a job in a chemistry laboratory, and I started to realize that I didn't mind the work. It was air-conditioned. People were talking to me with respect. They were asking me to solve problems. And I started to think maybe this is kind of interesting. And so I started studying a little bit. Then I took a few more classes to prepare myself for graduate school. And I went then to graduate school at Vanderbilt University in Nashville, Tennessee. And I was very purposed. And pharmaceuticals for me was sort of the ultimate goal in that I felt like I could apply chemistry to biological systems specifically for human good and flourishing.
Well, that's pretty cool. So I know you have a discovery related to or some discussion here related to pharmaceuticals and drugs. So why don't you go ahead and just kind of tell us a little bit about what you found or what's interesting here.
I was approached by NASA a few years ago, maybe 5-6 years ago, because my work has been primarily in the stability of drugs and how they degrade, how fast they degrade, how to stabilize them so that you have a good shelf life and you have a pure drug. What NASA was interested in is the stability of drugs for the Mars mission. So this would be a 3-year mission that they're planning for. It's a 2 to 3, probably closer to 3. And the kind of characteristics you have in space for drug stability have not been explored as thoroughly as what we have here on Earth, terra firma.
Right. Yeah. Well, and that's kind of got some popularity just because of the movie The Martian. I mean, the book is longer than that, but the movie's come out, and I thought the movie did a pretty good job of just communicating how hostile Mars is to life in some ways, but it also made it seem much more doable than it was. So,
yeah.
You said it's 3 years. I thought it's like 18 months to get to Mars, but the return trip is not going to be 18 months unless you wait quite a while. So, is it really just a 3-year trip, is what they're thinking?
My understanding in the conversations that I had when I was at NASA and what I've read is it's a 2 to 3 year mission. Now, I think maybe I don't know how long it's really going to be, but the idea from my perspective is you can't refill your drugs when they run out. So you have to they have to develop a drug formulary. What drugs are they going to take? What drugs might they possibly need? How many doses for however many astronauts they have on board? And will they be stable enough to where they're still efficacious or causing side effects for them when they start to get near the end?
That's a very good point. So what sorts of things did you find, or what are the answers here?
Well, one of the things I found, there's five main concerns that they have. They have microgravity concerns, they have vibration concerns, they have carbon dioxide concerns, because so these are variables that might influence drug stability. Hmm. And in addition to carbon dioxide, there's humidity in the inside spaceship and the ionizing radiation you get from space. And this will be a deep space trip because, the International Space Station is in what they call a low Earth orbit. So it still while it has a lot more radiation out there than we have on Earth because of the protection from the magnetosphere from Earth, mm-hmm. there is less, and so they get quite a bit more radiation on the International Space Station. But when they go into deep space, it's going to be higher still. So there's been some concern about that effect on drug stability.
No, and that's a very marked effect. I do gamma ray astronomy as mm-hmm. High energy astrophysics is my specialty, but gamma ray astronomy was the particular area that I studied. And one of the things that fascinated me is, we look at gamma rays down here on the ground, and these are, electromagnetic radiation, but cosmic rays are our background radiation. And there are very few cosmic rays that make it all the way down to the ground. So if you put a cosmic ray detector on the surface, you don't get too many. I mean, you can kind of count them every now and again, you'll get one. But if you take that same detector, put it up on top of the atmosphere, in a square meter, you'll get 1,000 of them every second. Mm. So it is a very radiation-rich environment out in space that our atmosphere really does a huge job of filtering all that out from the Earth. So this is the sort of stuff that, traveling along in a spaceship, you're going to be exposed to all of that radiation.
Right, you don't get much shielding from the metal that they'll use for the spaceship. If you wanted to have shielding, you'd have to have lead.
Right.
Containers, and that's too heavy to take up there. In fact, my understanding is on the International Space Station, when there's a solar flare and there's a lot of high energy radiation coming out, they have so many minutes because they can see the flare, and they will get warned from Houston, retreat to the interior, and then they get behind these lead shielded protections.
Okay.
But they don't think that they're going to be able to do that for the trip to Mars because of that extra weight required and how difficult it's. So there's a risk as they're going through a 2 to 3 year trip that a major solar flare could happen. So it's almost to cross your fingers and hope that doesn't happen during the trip.
Oh yeah, that's interesting. I mean, to your point, I mean we. For whatever reason, we get these lead bricks. I mean, they're actually just regular bricks, and you think you pick up a brick, okay, there's that. And I almost can't pick one up with just a hand. It's that heavy. So, I mean, lead's pretty dense metal.
Pretty dense.
So,
and while it's not very heavy out in space, because you're getting it up out there is very energy demanding. And,
right.
They have a tremendous consideration for minimizing the weight, and everything is minimized so that they can manage a three-year trip.
It gets really expensive the more mass you put up there. So if you don't, I mean, what have they found? I mean, is there any research or what have you found in terms of the drug stability as we're looking at this? Is it, can you keep things stable for the 2 to 3 year trip that you need?
So there's been limited studies done with the International Space Station, but they have about 6 or 7 studies that have been conducted on various drugs. I think about 40 or 50 of them. Maybe 36, somewhere in that range, and they've tried to compare the stability in the space station to Earth, mm-hmm. and they conclude basically it's about the degradation rate is about 50% faster in space right now.
Okay,
but
that's not egregious. That's not bad
in my
assessment. So,
in a 3 year time period, they expect that most of the drugs, as they're currently packaged and used in the International Space Station, will expire. They'll be past their shelf life. So you run some risk of lack of efficacy, and you run some risk of side effects from the degradation products that form.
So is that just, I mean, I know most products, you know, used by whatever, there's kind of like the, we're going to put this on and there's a margin of error that really, okay, yeah, this is a, to make sure nothing goes wrong. But in actuality, I mean, you can use ketchup a year or two after it's gone bad or expired and it's still fine. Is it that sort of thing, or is it they actually see a decrease in the efficacy after that time?
I think it's going to be more the former, more of the idea that there is an increased risk for them, maybe long-term, possibly, but the risks of the drug causing the problem is sort of pales in comparison to the biological effects of radiation that they're going to and weightlessness that they're going to be experiencing for that long term. So it's probably not the most serious of health concerns for them. But it's one they want to minimize and understand. And I'll, you know, one of the interesting things I found about that is that the CO2 levels kept in the space station, and will be also in this Mars trip, is about tenfold higher than we normally have here on Earth when we breathe.
Okay.
Just because of the recirculation and everything. So your CO2 is a little higher, tenfold higher, but it's still, it's manageable by humans.
Right.
But that higher increase in CO2 may be associated with some of the drug instability.
Oh, really? Okay.
CO2 sort of adsorbs to the surface of compounds, and it can make it a little acidic when it hydrates. So it can make reduce the pH of it a little bit. So that's one of the concerns. They've studied the effect of ionizing radiation at the doses they expect to receive in gamma radiation for the trip, and they conclude that that's probably not a serious effect of drug stability.
So the amount of radiation that's out there isn't going to really do much to the efficacy of the drug. Flip side is humans are exposed to that. So that's part of actually why you're going to need some sort of drugs.
Right.
Is that you're going to be exposed to this radiation and you're going to need something to counter that over a long-term duration.
Exactly. And further, the way the bodies are able to absorb and utilize the drugs do change because the biochemistry changes in space somewhat. And there's some concern about, and they've had some experience with certain drugs not being as efficacious. They have like nausea drugs that are one of the first things that they need to use, because usually they go through some sort of nausea as they adjust to weightlessness.
Right, okay.
And sometimes those don't work as well. And there's fluids that build up and things that change biologically that make the drugs less effective, more so than the drug degrading.
So those are changes in the human body that make the drug less effective just because of the way the human body is processing it.
Exactly.
Oh, that's fascinating. So
exactly. And there was one other thing I was going to mention. The biggest effect on the drug stability in space, as they've studied it so far, is the fact that NASA repackages the drugs for space and weight concerns, and they put them in basically Ziploc bags or little hard polypropylene containers, which don't protect the drug like the original packaging does.
Oh, that's a good point, yeah.
And they believe right now, their hypothesis is that is the primary reason for the increased drug instability. So there's going to be efforts to figure out how to repackage them in more protective packaging and maybe extending the shelf life more than it currently is, so that you don't have that 50% increase in degradation rate. Maybe you're close to the same kind of a shelf life as you would get on Earth.
You know, this is all your discussion. It kind of parallels some of the things that I want to talk about. But yeah, you know, there's this idea that space travel is, I mean, if you look in the popular, space travel is just inevitable. We're going to figure out how to travel between the stars.
We've seen it. We've seen it on Star Trek and Star Wars, and we know it can be done.
Exactly, yeah. But the practical, real-world getting out and doing it, I mean, even just going into low Earth orbit around the Earth, or it wouldn't be called low Earth orbit, there are just lots of things that start showing up. I mean, you know, the one that everybody seems to know about is you just lose muscle mass because you're in a microgravity environment. So you use it or lose it type thing in the gym is, if you don't use it, you're going to lose it. Well, you go out into space, you just don't need it. And what one of the interesting studies I found was that, you know, they looked at various muscles and which one degrade, and then which ones can they actually, can you get, they looked at just the muscle size.
Mm-hmm.
And they said typically those recovered fairly quickly. Yeah, they would recover. But they found that in terms of muscle density, for like a 6-month trip, 2 to 4 years later, there were certain muscles that still hadn't recovered all of their muscle mass. So it's not like, okay, we got this little bit of problem where we're there. You come back and then everything just recovers after a bit. It's like it may not ever recover entirely or back to the original state at all.
And especially when we don't even understand. That's typically, I think, the maximum is maybe around 6 months exposure.
Typically, yeah.
And this will be much longer than that. So that there's some unknown and there's some concern. But I think the people that sign up for this are going to have to be aware of this is a life-threatening kind of – they may or may not make it back. Or if they do make it back, they may have long-term health effects from that space travel.
Yeah.
Which calls the attention to the reality that space is a harsh environment.
It really is, yeah.
It's not very amenable to life forms.
Well, that was one of the others, and again, it's just related at radiation exposure, is that we have, just to use the vernacular, it's like these, they're what we call NK cells. They're called natural killer cells. That they are white blood cells that kill cancer cells and prevent viral cells within the body from reactivating. And so looking at how do these NK cells fare out in space, and it turns out that I think these are long-duration space flights, so like mm-hmm. the six-month, that those NK cells decreased by 50%. Now, that's 6 months. We've got at least a year and a half to get to Mars. So if that's – it's unclear whether that's a linear thing.
Exactly.
So 6 months is 50%. And in 12 months at zero, or whether it's 50% and then 50%, whether it's exponential or however it decays. But you're now putting yourself in this particular thing, you're putting yourself in an environment where your natural defenses against cancerous cells are way down. At the same time, you're exposing yourself to things that will cause cancerous cells.
Yes.
And in particular, what I found interesting about that was that it's not just, okay, you're reducing your immunity or natural defenses against cancer, that these are the cells that keep all the diseases you've had in your body at bay.
Yeah.
So say you had, smallpox, chickenpox as a kid, or you had some other disease that, okay, your body's figured out how to handle and it's suppressing it. The longer you're out in space, these things are all just going to... the way I read the literature, it says these things can start to reactivate. Mm-hmm. And this is now a problem because, I mean, if what you're saying is the longer you're out there, the less efficacious the drugs are, the things you would do to prevent that or help. It's like it really is a pretty hostile environment.
Hostile environment, and it's a difficult problem to solve because if you think about all the drugs you might need in the course of 3 years, for – whatever, antihistamines and pain medication for headaches and various things. But now you've got to think about, well, what if somebody starts coming down with some serious illnesses? What are the treatments for that? How many of those do we need to include in our formulary?
Right.
And how do we protect those and store those?
Mm-hmm. Well, and it struck me with your discussion about the, I asked the question about, is it effective after the expiration date? I work a long time on ground-based experiments, and, if something goes wrong on the ground, you just go out and you fix it. Well, in space, I'm now working on a balloon experiment where you don't get the, ooh, I messed up, let's go fix it. It's mm-hmm. got to work right. So in some sense, you've got to know, or where it starts to fail, you can't take the risk that maybe this is the one that did, and 90% of it might work, but you might have gotten the one in the batch of 10% that don't work. You can't afford that out in space. It's got to work or else you got real problems out there.
Yeah. So also the number of each, like let's say they're tablets or their capsules, how many for mm-hmm. however many astronauts do you have to have out there? And then how quickly can they access them? Where are they stored? What diseases could crop up? It becomes a more significant issue the more I think about it. I'm sure NASA is way ahead of me, but it was interesting to get some insight as mm-hmm. to hear this large panel talk about these issues.
Yeah, one other one that I'd want to throw in, because I think it would be related to this, or your study about drug efficacy, is that one of the studies they did was on the intestinal tract, because that's mm-hmm. where – it has a fairly quick recycling period. And one of the things they found is that mice exposed to radiation doses, similar to those encountered on a trip to Mars, they showed that the cosmic rays actually disrupted the renewing of the gastrointestinal tract, because that's kind of like a 3 to 5 day renewal type period. But if we're talking about drugs, wouldn't that impact, or, you know, if that's what's going on, so the longer you're in space, the slower your, or, you know, it disrupts your gastrointestinal tract, that would seem to have implications for drug efficacy, regardless of how normally efficacious they would be.
And I think that is what they're more concerned with. I think that's the biggest concern. Of course, you don't want to magnify that with drug stability, but the whole idea, if you're taking an oral drug and your GI tract is somehow modified or compromised a little bit, you may not absorb anywhere near what you need for an efficacious dose. So all of a sudden, you might have to take more. And then you might, certain things might absorb better than others, and you can have side effects from that. So there, it's a risky, complicated, concerning thing that they are certainly trying to anticipate as best they can.
So I'm curious, you know, this is maybe, you know, we've got this concerns about how long will drugs actually work. You know, we know the parameters are at least, I mean, like I said, I think it takes 18 months to get to Mars in the best case. So we're at least 18 months, whether it's 3 years, whether it's five, however long you're going to be exposed to these sorts of environments. That, you know, can your drugs that we know we're going to need, because like I said, you're going to be high radiation, or you're fairly high radiation. I think I did a calculation once that on a standard trip, just based on, I think, I want to say it was Curiosity, they had radiation dosimeters or a way to measure the radiation levels, that in that 5 year period, you're exposed to about 20% of a lethal dose of radiation. Granted, it's spread out over 5 years. So, and it's lethal at all at one time. But we've got to do something to help the body recover from that or minimize the effects of that.
Right.
That in all of this, you know, we have these problems with muscles and mental issues that come up. I mean, it just seems like there's this whole slew of things that come up in that. So kind of step back and ask the question, what do you see apologetically? What are some interesting things that you see out of that? I've got a couple of ideas, but I'm curious what your takeaway is.
Well, what comes to mind to me instantly is how wonderfully Earth is made for us to live on.
Amen.
And how hostile it is everywhere else that we can see. It's amazing how protected and how well-designed or tweaked or just right Earth is to allow us to live and have defenses against disease, to have food, to... I mean, this is, as we go outside and enjoy the sunshine or the rain, it is so much more hospitable than what's on the outside of Earth.
It almost kind of reminds me of, I've just recently been reading through Genesis, and, you know, Adam and Eve were put into the garden, and the garden is this place that was just, I always have this image, not, I mean, it may be lush paradise, but it's more, it's like everything just works well here, you know, and after they rebelled, it's like, we're going to remove you from the Garden of Eden primarily so that they couldn't eat of the tree of life and live forever. But comes with that, now you're going to have to go out where everything's just really hard. That I see that parallel, like everything on Earth, it just works well. I mean, the rain works, the sun works, the food cycle works. Yeah. You put stuff in the ground and it grows. In fact, some places you just can't keep stuff from growing even if you tried. You know, it's just, to your point, it's like Earth is this nursery of, it just works really well.
Well, you can almost see an analogy between Eden and what was outside of Eden being much more harsh and wild, and Earth and what's outside of Earth. Now, Earth can be pretty harsh and wild for life. I mean, there are some pretty harsh and difficult things about living on Earth, but when you compare it to what's outside, life can hardly exist. I mean, it's hard. You're almost down to absolute zero in no time. As a vacuum, and if you get on a planet, the gravity's either too strong that would crush you, or too light to have any air or any breathable air that can use. So it becomes more obvious how Earth is kind of a just right Goldilocks kind of scenario.
Yeah. Well, and to that point, I actually remember one of the astronomy classes I took in college. We were doing a calculation based on Earth's gravity and its temperature. One of the fascinating things is that Earth's gravity, given the temperature of the surface of the Earth, Earth's gravity is just strong enough to hold on to water in the atmosphere because the escape rate is determined by the molecular weight, and water, H2O, is 18. But it's not strong enough to hold on to ammonia and methane, which are 17 and 16. So it's like we're
right at the edge.
Just right at the edge so that we don't, I mean, and we think, okay, ammonia and methane, those are kind of toxic for, I mean, that's a little bit of an overstatement, but given advanced life like humanity, having a bunch of ammonia and methane in the Earth would be, or in the atmosphere would be kind of toxic. So Earth is just big enough, but not too big. And yeah. So, you know, to your point, I think Earth is just right in a lot of ways. It's not too big, it's not too small. It's got all of those things really do play out well. So, last question for you. Given all of what we just found, and you alluded to this in your comment, would you go to Mars if they offered you the chance?
No, not me.
No, okay.
Because I think the risk of it.
And I'll even sweeten the pot.
Sweeten
you
the
get
pot,
to
okay.
be the first person to go to Mars.
No.
No, you still
there,
know.
There are more adventurous people than I'm adventurous, but I'm not that adventurous. For one, it's be such a chunk of your life at
okay.
this stage. I'm 65 years old. It would be, and. And then once you, if you make it back, I think there's going to be problems, and I think there's a reasonable, you know, a reasonably high percentage of chance that not everybody would make it back, or maybe they'd all don't make it back. So mm-hmm. you're going with knowing that it might not. You don't know the success rate. We don't have any any metrics on how many times you go and what's the likelihood of making it. And I'm not that adventurous. And it just doesn't. And it's not like you're going to. If it was going to a place that once you get there, it's like the Garden of Eden, or you know, really nice. That might be worth the risk.
Okay, all right. Okay.
When you get there, it's like this is really cold. It's all CO2. There's no plants, no anything. There's no internet here, so.
well, there's nobody to communicate nobody with out there anyway.
So I don't know. Mars ain't the kind of place to raise your kids, is what an Elton John said, and I think that's still true.
That's funny because I'm inclined to be along with you in that, but there is this aspect of being the first to mm-hmm. explore a planet, which. You know, I'm kind of, is it worth dying to be the first person to do this? And yeah. I'm like, given the fact I have enough responsibilities. I mean, my kids are still in the house and stuff like that. So that makes an easy answer if somebody were asking me today. But if you ask me in 20 years when all my family's out, except for the fact.
You'd be tempted.
I'd be tempted because it's like everybody's going to remember. I mean, everybody knows who Neil Armstrong was because he's the first person in
right.
space. And whether he had problems afterwards because of that is, you know, I don't know. But I could see myself being tempted to take it. And I know people who would say, oh, yeah, I'd go because I'd get to be the first. So it's kind of funny the difference across human personalities there.
Yeah. There is one aspect that's intrigued me. If you could hit a golf ball, how far it would go, that might be kind of an interesting.
That's an interesting question because the gravity is quite a bit less there.
Yeah.
I do know atmosphere-wise, on the surface of Mars, it is 50 times less atmosphere than the top of Mount Everest on the surface of Mars.
Wow.
So you're already dying up on the top of Mount Everest. You're just dying a lot faster on the surface of Mars.
And it's even colder and most of the time on the surface of
Earth. It's a little nippy, yeah. So.
A little nippy. So how much would you weigh on the surface of Mars?
You know, I don't have that number off the top of my head. I know
is
that
like
Mars,
one-fifth or something?
Mars has a mass. Well, the moon is 1/6, so it's going to be more than one-sixth. Because
yeah,
Mars has a...
I feel like
a,
it was 1/3 to 1/4 in that range.
Something like that. That makes sense. I that's just one of those numbers I don't have on the top of my head. But now I'm going to go look it up,
yeah,
and I'll remember
right,
it
right.
after this. So. Well, hey, I appreciate your time, Steve. And I really do, just in our discussion, it's remarkable how well Earth supports life. I mean, it really does point to God has designed this is a place for us. That's what Scripture
yeah.
says all along.
Right.
I just appreciate the studies of what we see as we're even just trying to take medicines other places, find another piece of evidence that just shows how amenable to life Earth is compared to what a lot of the rest of the universe looks like.
Absolutely.
So I appreciate your discussion. I want to thank you for joining us today on Star, Cells, and God. I encourage you to join the discussion in the comments below. Let us know what you think about this. Remember to like this video, to subscribe for more content. New episodes of Star Cells and God release each Wednesday. They're available here on YouTube and on your favorite podcast app. Please make sure to share this video with a friend. Remember, the more we know about science, the more reasons we have to believe.